It's the Friday afternoon Paul Harris Show here on the Big 550 KTRS. Tim's keeping an eye on the roads, which are not all that full because a lot of people got out of work a couple of hours ago. But he'll update you on any accidents and slowdowns again in just a few minutes. And, of course, Max is here in the studio with me to do what we do every Friday in the 4 o'clock hour, and that is to talk about the new movies that are out. And there are a whole bunch of them that are being released this weekend. Last night, a friend asked, why do they save all the good movies to be released all at the same time in the course of 3 or 4 days? Why didn't they spread these out over the course of the fall? And the answer is they tried to, but Star Wars came along and took up every screen.
I also think that that's sort of a misnomer. I was putting together an early list of my best of for this year, mm-hmm. and only one or two have come out in the last couple of months. There's a lot of things from earlier this year, mm-hmm. or even the summer, that will be on my best of list. There's more films that come out in the last 2 months that try to be good, and one of those is on my worst of list.
Okay. Well, we're going to get to the worst movies of 2017 later on in this hour, but first let's start with a couple of the movies that are opening this weekend. And if you don't mind, Max, I'm going to start with a movie called All the Money in the World. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this is because you actually talked to the director, Ridley Scott.
Yeah, one of the highlights of my entire career has been being fortunate enough to not get tongue-tied, as I just got tongue-tied right now, when I was interviewing Ridley Scott. I was beside myself for hours after that. We aired it today on The Inside with John Grayson and Jennifer Blum at 10:30. It's actually up on SoundCloud right now. If you go to KTRS.com on the Max Movies page, you can listen to it. And we were talking about Kevin Spacey, Christopher Plummer, and, of course, All the Money in the World.
Well, one of the positive things that came out of the Me Too movement this year has been a removal of powerful men from powerful positions, including, most notably, Kevin Spacey from this movie. When the news broke with the charges of Spacey's alleged history of sexually assaulting an underage boy and others, Ridley Scott, the director of All the Money in the World, was stuck with a real problem. He had finished production on this movie.
Now, it had a release date and they were ready to go.
And Spacey's in one of the featured roles in the movie, and he was worried that the scandal would kill the movie's potential box office. So Scott did something I've never heard of anybody doing before, where he convinced the studio to give him more money to go back and reshoot Kevin Spacey's scenes as J. Paul Getty, replacing him with Christopher Plummer, which is the guy that Scott wanted originally for the role. And ironically, the studio said, no, you got to get somebody who's a bigger name.
How about Kevin Spacey?
Kevin Spacey's a bigger name than Christopher Plummer?
Maybe at the box office, which is what they were worried. That's what they wanted. They wanted a bigger return. But Christopher Plummer is an incredible actor, and I would tell every director out there, or every casting agent, if you have an older person role in a movie, hire an older person. There's great older actors
out there. Instead of putting Kevin Spacey in horrible prosthetics and makeup.
Thank you.
Almost as ridiculous as Woody Harrelson as LBJ a couple of weeks ago. Now, in the news stories about this, I had been led to believe that it was a supporting role that was so small that Ridley Scott would have no trouble getting the band back together for a redo of a few scenes in the 9 days or so he had before the movie had to be delivered to make it in time for release this weekend.
9 days.
In reality, I'm here to tell you after seeing the movie, Christopher Plummer is in quite a bit of the movie, often in sets that are large and complex, which they had to reconstruct, which makes this achievement even more worthy of our attention. And I'll also say this, at 88 years old, Christopher Plummer, perfect for the role of J. Paul Getty. I wonder what went through the heads of those studio execs who initially said, no, we can't have Plummer, use Spacey. After they saw Plummer's performance in this, they must have just said, well, I have to quit now. I can't possibly stay in the film business anymore. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. That didn't happen, of course. Plummer is great in this, but he's not the only reason to see All the Money in the World. First, let me tell you the plot. It involves the real-life kidnapping of J. Paul Getty's 16-year-old grandson, Paul, in Rome, Italy, by men who intend to hold him until they can get J. Paul Getty to pay a huge ransom. At that point, Getty was the richest man, not just in America, but in the history of the planet, as they say in the movie. And remarkably, he refused to give up even a small piece of his wealth to save his grandson. He claimed that if he did pay the ransom, then his other grandchildren would be at risk of being kidnapped, too. But what we find out as the movie goes along is J. Paul Getty, the only thing he loved more than having money was getting more money. And so the idea of giving anyone anything was anathema to him. Now, stuck in the middle of this is Gail, who's Paul's mother, the kidnapped kid's mother, and J. Paul Getty's daughter-in-law. It is a meaty role, and it is inhabited by Michelle Williams with the force of other female protagonists in Ridley Scott movies. Thelma and Louise. Ripley in Alien. Too many times in the past, Michelle Williams has been cast just as the hero's wife. Manchester by the Sea, The Greatest Showman, which came out this week, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, Brokeback Mountain. In this one, Michelle Williams grabs the spotlight and runs with it, and it is, Max, a stunning performance. It reminded me of when I was in New York a couple of years ago, and I saw her on Broadway with Jeff Daniels in a production of a two-hander called Blackbird. They're both on stage the whole time. And her energy and his both leapt off the stage. It was one of the most exciting nights I've ever had in the theater. Now, I've heard other moviegoers complain that All the Money in the World doesn't reveal much information about Paul, the grandson, who's played by Charlie Plummer, who's no relation.
Right.
But that didn't bother me one bit, because his backstory is irrelevant. It's like who he is the MacGuffin.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to know that. His kidnapping gets the plot rolling, and that's all it is. The supporting cast has Mark Wahlberg as Fletcher Chase, an ex-CIA operative who does Getty's bargaining in business, but feels sympathy for Gail and what she's going through as she battles against J. Paul Getty.
Is this Mark Wahlberg in his Departed level of acting or his Transformers level of acting?
Departed.
Okay.
It's the good Mark Wahlberg. He does a good job, too. It's also nice to see the underused Timothy Hutton playing J. Paul Getty's attorney. But the movie really belongs to Scott's brilliant direction and the performances of Michelle Williams and Christopher Plummer. I'm giving it an 8.5 out of 10. All
Fantastic.
The Money in the World.
Nice.
Really, really, really good. And I think my view of it is definitely elevated by the amazing achievement of taking out an actor who's in maybe not 60% of the movie, maybe only a third of the movie, but getting Michelle Williams and Mark Wahlberg back.
To come back, right.
To do those scenes with him. It's a remarkable achievement.
Now, usually actors have it in their contracts that they must return for any and all reshoots as deemed by the director, because that's just part of it. But this had wrapped production.
Yeah,
it was done.
Right.
They still came back for no additional pay.
Now, what did Ridley Scott tell you about this when you talked to him?
You know, my first question was, did you ever think at the 11th hour, I'm just going to release the film as it was? And his response was no. He thought that the movie would have never been released, much like Louis C.K.'s movie, I Love You, Daddy, which was just never released. He thought, nobody will ever see this. And so my follow-up question was, do you think we'll ever see the Kevin Spacey version? And he said, well, you know, ultimately it's not up to him, but he could see in 10 years or so, just curiosity's sake, basically, what did that look like? But this is his definitive version of the film. And, you know, hearing you, Paul, give it an 8.5, I mean, Kevin Spacey is a phenomenal actor, of course. He's a multiple award winner. I imagine he would have been great in this role, but wouldn't you have always thought, wow, that's some pretty decent old age makeup on Kevin Spacey?
Yeah.
Whereas at least with Christopher Plummer, who is also a legend, and you know it's Christopher Plummer, but he could maybe inhabit the role a little bit better.
Yes, and because he's that age, he's so much more relatable. Then you're constantly thinking, oh, that's Kevin Spacey in makeup.
Right. It's somebody who is 88 thinking, no, that's my money. I mean, so I'm just happy that Scott got a chance to make the film he wanted to make in the first place.
Absolutely. All right, second movie to review today is called The Shape of Water, which I did not see, but you did, so take it.
The Shape of Water is the latest film from Guillermo del Toro, who is a critic's darling and also sort of a fanboy darling as well. Everything that this guy does, the critics usually fawn over, and he has a whole lot of fans as well. I've had him on my show years ago. We were actually talking about his version of the Hobbit movies that he was going to direct. Peter Jackson was going to just produce those movies, and he was going to direct them, and that whole deal fell through, and Peter Jackson ended up making that trilogy instead, for better or worse. Guillermo del Toro has had a whole lot of projects over the years that he has promised to deliver, and then because of funding and financing, they've fallen by the wayside. A lot of directors are like that, but whenever he says, I'm going to make this movie next, I never really believe it. He's talked about making The Shape of Water for a long time. He's wanted to make his version of the Beauty and the Beast tale, and his main criticism of all the different versions of Beauty and the Beast is that the movies don't go full tilt enough with the intimacy between the two species, because he's thinking if you fall in love, Wouldn't you do more than just buy them flowers?
So he hated Splash because Tom Hanks never banged Daryl Hannah on camera.
You know, if you ask me what the best interspecies romance movie is this year, it's the live-action Beauty and the Beast with Emma Watson. I thought that was really well done and improved on the cartoon in a couple of ways. But Shape of Water is following in those footsteps. This is his version of Beauty and the Beast. But instead of a warthog, we have an amphibian man who is mercifully not done with CGI. This is a man in suit, and this is because Guillermo del Toro loves old monster movies, and he has a longtime collaborator named Doug Jones. Not the guy who beat Roy Moore. This is a different Doug Jones. He played Abe Sapien in del Toro's Hellboy films. He was also the Pale Man in Pan's Labyrinth, which is absolutely del Toro's masterpiece. And he is the amphibian man here, who is being held in a secret government lab in the 1950s. And he's discovered by Sally Hawkins, who plays a mute named Eliza, and her best friend, played by Octavia Spencer, who are custodians. They clean the bathrooms, they clean the floors, and the government officials pay them no mind. She sees this amphibian man who is being experimented on by the evil Michael Shannon, who is your prototypical 1950s alpha male. His wife is subservient. His kids kiss them before they go to school. He eats his TV dinners while he's watching TV. He buys a Cadillac. Very 1950s alpha male type guy. And he wants to dissect this amphibian man and see what makes him tick. But Michael Stuhlbarg, the great character actor who's had a great couple of years, he was an Arrival last year, he wants to save the creature, although he has some ulterior motives as to why. Sally Hawkins, as I pointed out, she plays a mute character, and while she's great in this movie and her face is very filled, and her sign language is fantastic, but I don't know why they wouldn't have tried to go out of their way to cast a mute actress in this role, because I think that, you know, much like the J. Paul Getty discussion, I always knew that Sally Hawkins was acting, because mm-hmm. I know that she can in fact speak, but whatever. She is playing a role very similar to Audrey Tautou in the old French film Amelie.
Look, let me just interrupt.
Yes.
They didn't hire the mute actress because it would have been hard to do the commentary on the DVD.
Perhaps you're right. Unless they put like closed captions or something in there for the sign language. So she's sort of playing like an Audrey Tautou type in Amelie, which means it's very whimsical and very fairy tale like. Her apartment looks almost like something out of The Shire, and there's books everywhere. It's a very strange apartment. Her best friend is played by Richard Jenkins, who brings a whole lot of, weariness to his role. It's a very kindly shut in guy who doesn't have any friends either, and they form this bond. And again, it's just her story of falling in love with this creature and trying to save him from the evil government people. Now, I must admit, I am usually not a fan of Guillermo del Toro's movies. A lot of the films that other people like Kronos and Devil's Backbone and the two Hellboy movies and Blade 2 and Crimson Peak, I don't like any of those movies. I do think his masterpiece and the only movie that's really worked for me is Pan's Labyrinth. I think it's fantastic. But every other fairy tale he's done has just sort of left me flat. There's a La La Land-esque type of dream scene in this movie where she dances with the amphibian man that I think is supposed to tug at your heartstrings, but I just kind of laughed at it. Mm. She's dancing with a 6-foot-tall reptile.
Mm-hmm.
So this love story did not make me feel engaged. I didn't care for anybody, and I understand that in a fairy tale, your characters are archetypes. I understand that. But nobody here colors outside the lines. You know that the government people are bad. You know that the asset has to be saved. Mm-hmm. You know that Sally Hawkins is good. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I understand that he's doing this on purpose, but it also makes for a pretty predictable movie.
And you know that Octavia Spencer is once again playing a supporting character when somebody will finally come along and say, you know what? She could lead a movie.
Yeah, let's give her a movie.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's a great point. I mean, Viola Davis did that for years before people started casting her in the
movie. Right.
That's a great point. The cast is phenomenal, especially Richard Jenkins, and the effects are very good too. But I wanted so much more from this movie, and quite frankly, I am shocked and surprised that so many critics groups are giving this movie Best Picture. The St. Louis Film Critics, of which I am a member, gave this Best Picture.
Wow.
And I didn't even enjoy it.
Wow. So, yeah. What did you give it on a scale of 0 to 10?
I would give this a 4, Paul.
Okay.
Mainly because of the acting. It's pretty good.
All right. That's called The Shape of Water. And our third movie to review for you today is called The Greatest Showman. This actually opened up on Wednesday, but they want people to go in for the whole long Christmas weekend to go see this, and they're pitching it as a family musical about P.T. Barnum, who gathered a group of unusual characters and acts together to create what would become known as the first circus. And of course, Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey. Well, that's Barnum is P.T. Barnum, who started this in the 19th century. And it stars Hugh Jackman as Barnum and Michelle Williams as his wife and Zac Efron as his business partner. And the circus acts include a bearded lady and a dwarf and Siamese twins and a brother and sister trapeze act and a tattooed man and a giant. And these are the kind of performers who would later populate sideshows at carnivals, but Barnum put them front and center to exploit the curiosity of average Americans 150 years ago. The director of this movie, Michael Gracie, fills the screen with a lot of spectacle. There's a love story. There's 9 original songs by Benj Pasek and Justin Paul. They are the people who won Oscars for their songs for La La Land. Mm. And they also got Tonys for Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway. And they also wrote the songs for A Christmas Story, the musical, which was terrible on Fox on Sunday night. Unfortunately, in this movie, The Greatest Showman, every tune is delivered as a showstopper. And none of them is particularly memorable. Actually, they're anachronistic because they have a too contemporary feel. Mm. There's one character at one point who's introduced as a famous opera singer who then goes on to sing not one aria or anything else in that genre. Instead, she's doing modern show tune-ish numbers that just don't work. As for Hugh Jackman, he is a dynamic presence on screen, just as he was as Wolverine and every other character he's played.
He's wanted to sing and dance for a long time on screen.
He can sing. He can dance. You ask my wife about this. She gives the female perspective. There is nothing wrong with Hugh Jackman.
Sure.
But watching him and the rest of the cast, I couldn't help but think that the whole production would be better on stage. This should have been a Broadway musical, not a movie. The energy of the performances by Jackman and some of the rest of the cast, particularly a woman named Keala Settle as the bearded lady, they don't translate as well through the camera as they would in a live theater setting. You can do showstoppers on stage, and they are better than they are on film. There actually was a Broadway musical called Barnum in the 1980s. It starred Jim Dale and Michael Crawford, but The Greatest Showman is not based on that, and the songs are all original. There's also a question of timing for this movie. Hugh Jackman had been trying to get this movie going for 7, 8, 9, 10 years. Studios didn't want to take on an original musical. And then La La Land came along last year and almost won the Oscar for Best Picture. And that changed their mind. And they decided to make this. Here's the problem. The real circus, the one that Barnum started with Bailey and the Ringling Brothers, was dying.
It's gone.
It finally closed forever earlier this year, mostly because it was no longer unique in a digital world where we have access on demand to any kind of entertainment we want.
And there's been a lot of backlash for circuses, and especially circus animals recently.
Absolutely.
How much do you think that the old shareholders would have thought, you could have released this 1 year earlier to give us some publicity?
Because now, or 5 years ago,
right, yeah,
if they had made it before all of this started up. The Greatest Showman has a lot of effort, and I think the word boisterous effort could even be thrown in there. But it just isn't enough. I give it a 5 out of 10. So those are our 3 new movie reviews for this week. Now, I do have to mention there are other movies coming out this week. One is called Downsizing with Matt Damon, which is pretty much getting slammed by the critics. There's a movie called Father Figures with Owen Wilson and Ed Helms that has a 0 on Rotten Tomatoes.
You mean Step Brothers?
No.
Okay.
I'm glad we didn't go see that. There's Pitch Perfect 3 with Anna Kendrick and the crew back again for yet another
acapella singing.
Same movie, yeah, third time. And there's a gay love story called Call Me By Your Name. We didn't see any of those 4 movies, so we can't review them for you here today. The 5th of those that I have to mention, though, is not on the big screen. It's on Netflix.
Oh, yes.
And it's a Will Smith project called Bright, which looks from the trailer like a remake of Alien Nation, the old movie with James Caan and Mandy Patinkin that became a Fox TV series for a couple of years. In this one, it's not an alien from another planet, but mythological characters.
It's an orc.
Okay, whatever that is. And Will Smith plays a human, and they're both cops, and they have to do, I don't know what they have to do. Here's what I have to ask you, though, and this is a question from a listener named Joe Sturdy, who said, this movie, Bright, from Will Smith, cost $90 million to make. And it's only streaming on Netflix. How can it make a profit?
You know, Netflix has been just hemorrhaging money as far as giving Scorsese a whole bunch of money to make The Irishman. And, of course, this Will Smith movie called Bright, which they've already ordered a sequel on.
What?
Yeah, that's what they came out today to say.
Boy,
we're going to do a sequel.
Every critic hates this.
I don't think they care that, because people are going to be in front of their TV and they can hit play. They're not going to, I mean, it's not like really, I think criticism, what I'm trying to say is criticism affects box office a lot more than streaming, because with box office, you have to get in the car, get a babysitter, go out, pay, you know, sit through the
damn trailers.
Exactly. Whereas at home, it's a snap decision. Hey, look, Will Smith, I'm going to hit play.
Well, I wonder if Netflix is going to look at the stats on this and realize a lot of people did not watch this whole movie. A lot of people turned it off pretty quickly.
Or it could be a huge success for them. Just because critics didn't like it doesn't mean a Will Smith movie on demand in your living room won't be huge. I kind of think it's going to be gigantic for them. And Will Smith's last collaboration with this director, David Ayer, was Suicide Squad, which did very well at the theaters.
We'll never know if it's a success or not, because Netflix doesn't release those numbers.
Right.
And there's the key. But how can it make a profit? Well, if it costs $90 million and Netflix paid them $200 million for the movie, that's how it makes a profit, Joe. But it doesn't make a profit based on how many people watch it, because that doesn't...
You don't pay a dollar to watch it.
Exactly. Yeah. So there you go. When we come back, we'll run down some of the worst movies of 2017 here on the Big 550 KTRS. All right, continuing along, talking about the showbiz stuff for the week here on the Big 550 KTRS. Next week, Max and I are going to run down our top 10 lists of the best movies of 2017. But while we have time here today, let's run down our lists of the worst movies of 2017. And we'll start with number one. We're not going to make you wait. We're going to start right at the top of the list. What movie is at the number one spot on your list, Max?
The Mummy.
See, now, before we go forward, I have to say, I don't see all the movies that come out. You don't see all the movies that come out.
Nobody does every year. Every critics list that you see with the best and worst, they didn't see all 360 some movies released every year.
Impossible.
Yeah.
The fact that we don't see all of them is why Woody Allen's Wonder Wheel is not on my list this year, although, according to other critics, it probably deserves to be there.
Well, and of course...
That would have put Woody on the list 3 years in a row, by the way.
And of course, the whole idea of telling people the worst movies of the year is just sort of silly. These are just... For me, these are the ones that I hated sitting through the most.
Well, that's why they are the worst.
And number one for me is The Mummy with Tom Cruise, which was supposed to usher in the so-called Dark Universe. Universal even put together a little trailer called Dark Universe that they played before The Mummy to let people know this is going to be a giant, epic, Marvel-esque cinematic universe. And everybody just kind of rolled their eyes.
And who is going to be in that universe? Frankenstein?
Well, you were going to have Frankenstein's monster, played by Javier Bardem.
Yes.
You're going to have the Invisible Man, played by Johnny Depp. I think a lot of people would like him to become the Invisible Man right now. You were going to have the Bride of Frankenstein, played by Angelina Jolie.
Mm-hmm.
And you were going to have Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, who is Russell Crowe.
What about the Wolfman?
Who made an appearance in the Mummy. Oh, the Wolfman. Did they cast the Wolfman?
I don't know.
I'm not sure if they cast the Wolfman. But this was all going to be led off by the Mummy, which headlined Tom Cruise, although he was not the Mummy. Of course. The Mummy was actually played by Sophia Boutella, who's a really talented actress, and she's wasted in this film, as everything is wasted in this film.
Wow.
It makes absolutely no sense. The action beats don't work. The Tom Cruise-ness of the movie, he's trying to do like a Mission Impossible with mummies chasing him, and let me tell you, it's as silly as that sounds.
Mm.
Universal should have just made a horror film, which is what made Universal Studios. All of these movies that we talked about, Dracula and The Wolfman, those were horror films.
They're not action movies.
No, and I think because of the influence of Marvel and Star Wars and Disney, basically, they said, we're going to have our own action movies, too. And, of course, that's not a dark universe. That's an action universe. So audiences stayed away in droves. And the only good thing that came out of this was, A, the cancellation of the entire dark universe, and, B, if you go to YouTube and type in Dark Universe trailer, somebody who worked for Universal edited together a bunch of clips from those original black and white movies, and it's amazing. But it just reminds you how great those movies were.
And how bad this one was. Okay, number one on my list is King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. I saw this movie, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. And I kept saying that while I was watching it. I don't know what the hell's going on. From the very first scene where CGI monsters attack a castle and hundreds of stunt people fall dead all over the place, I had no idea what was happening. I had not read any of the King Arthur folklore, so I don't know about the mystical powers of the Excalibur sword or who the monsters were or why there were eel women swimming in a water under the castle. And the movie doesn't bother explaining anything of that. Halfway through, I considered leaving the movie theater to go home and watch a great movie about King Arthur, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
You probably should have done that.
But I stayed to the end, and I am sorry I did. Did you see that movie?
I was a couple of rows behind you, and my number two worst movie is King Arthur, Legend of the Sword.
Okay.
It is just dreadful.
Well, then I'll go right on to my number two, which was number one for most of the year until King Arthur came along, and that is The Comedian.
Yes.
With Robert De Niro as Jackie Burke, a comedian whose career is on the skids, yet finds himself in the spotlight after video of him punching out a heckler goes viral. None of the comedy in this movie works. At least partly because it's so hard to make movies about stand-ups with actors who aren't comedians.
I only watched the trailer for this, Paul, because you warned me against it pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
But the trailer made me uncomfortable watching De Niro try to do stand-up.
You know, it was bad enough when Tom Hanks and Sally Field tried to do stand-up in Punchline. Seth Rogen and Adam Sandler, who used to be stand-ups, they couldn't do it in Funny People. Even Billy Crystal couldn't make a hit out of Mr. Saturday Night, although he was much better at mining the same bitter old comic turf for laughs. De Niro had terrible comic delivery and timing 30 years ago when he was playing Rupert Pupkin in King of Comedy opposite Jerry Lewis.
Genius movie.
That's a terrific Scorsese movie. This one, terrible. Terrible. Shame on you, Robert De Niro, for continuing to make dreck like this. The Comedian, number two on my list. Number three on yours.
Number three on mine is Transformers The Last Knight, which, yes, does star Mark Wahlberg. I watched this movie, Paul. I really did. I was in the theater with my eyes open and nothing in my ears, so all my senses were there. I don't know what The Last Knight is, and I watched this movie. This is the fifth Transformers film and possibly the most insipid, and that is really quite an achievement for an incomprehensible series. Michael Bay proves once again he can blow things up real good and make audiences cheer because they are basically bombed into submission.
Wow. Okay, number three on my list, The Sense of an Ending. And I'll say right now, when you name your movie The Sense of an Ending, you leave yourself wide open to easy shots for critics. For instance, I wish this movie with Jim Broadbent and Charlotte Rampling actually had an ending. Uh-huh. Or I was worried that it would never end. Or sitting through it made me wish I'd lost my senses of sight and hearing. You get the sense I didn't like this movie? You're right.
A little bit.
The end. That's the ending of this review. The end. Number four on your list.
A movie called Life. First of all, I hate the title. Life. What does it tell you? Nothing.
Mikey doesn't even like it.
Right, exactly. You think of The Serial. You think maybe of Keith Richards' biography. You think maybe of the Eddie Murphy movie called Life. The board game Life. Everything except this movie, which stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Ryan Reynolds. And it's basically an alien ripoff. They are on an expedition, and this spore gets on their ship. And, of course, the spore starts killing them one by one. I had heard going into this movie it was actually a top secret twist ending that was going to lead into an already established franchise. So I thought, well, that must be Alien. They must be, you know, there's going to be a xenomorph at the end. Nope, there was nothing. It just ends, and it makes you wish you hadn't wasted all the time.
I saw Life. I didn't like it. It didn't make my list, but I really didn't like it either.
It has monster vision. That's never good.
Number four on my list is The House, a Will Ferrell, Amy Poehler, alleged comedy. I didn't have high hopes for this. But I did not expect that it would come in so far below my already low expectations. I don't even have to tell you about this, except to tell you they set up a casino in their house. And the house loses. As a movie, as a casino, as everything, it cost $40 million to make. It brought in a total gross worldwide of $25 million. That means the house lost. Don't go see the house. Don't rent the house. Don't watch the house on Netflix. You lose if you see it. More of the worst movies of 2017 coming up after we take another quick break here on the Big 550 KTRS. Continuing along with our rundown of the worst movies of 2017. I am Paul Harris. Max Foyze is here with me. This is our Showbiz Hour every week here on the Big 550 KTRS. And we're down to your number five on the list, Max.
The Man Who Invented Christmas. This stars Dan Stevens as Charles Dickens, who apparently got the inspiration for writing A Christmas Carol because the characters came and spoke to him. in his house.
Ugh.
I hate that. I hate it. I hate it so much.
Yeah.
It takes any kind of creativity or hardship away from writing because your characters just come up to you and say, hey, Paul, why don't you put me in your book?
Right.
Oh, it's dreadful.
Not because Dickens was a great writer.
Yeah.
No, ghosts
just
gave him the
Scrooge
idea.
Scrooge came and talked to him. Oh. Come on now.
Number five on my list is a Richard Gere movie called The Dinner, in which he plays a congressman running for governor, and Steve Coogan is his brother, and Laura Linney and Rebecca Hall are their wives, and I like all four of those actors.
Great cast.
That is a great cast, but I can't recommend it. It is an American remake of an Italian movie based on a book by a Dutch author written and directed by an Israeli. It's some sort of cinematic version of the game Telephone, where by the time the message is translated through enough people, it makes no sense and has no value. The Dinner, number five on my worst of lists. You're number six.
The Dark Tower, based on a sprawling epic series of books by Stephen King.
Excuse me, let me interrupt to get to my number six. The Dark Tower,
yes,
based
yes.
on...
I mean, we had a great adaptation of Stephen King's work this year with It, the scary clown movie, and Dark Tower was everything that movie wasn't, namely bad.
Idris Elba, Matthew McConaughey.
I like them.
Both They're embarrassed great. To have been in this movie.
Yes, I think so.
Number seven on my list is Mother. Speaking of films with an incomprehensible plot, this is the mother of them all this year. It's the kind of movie where when Jennifer Lawrence goes to the basement and sees blood dripping down the walls, she doesn't tell anybody about it. Is it a horror movie? Is it a metaphor for writer's block? What the hell is it? I don't know. I don't care. I actually sympathize with Lawrence because she's trapped in that house with something terrible taking place, just like I was in the movie theater. Mother. Small M, exclamation point at the end. That tells you how pretentious the movie is. Wow, is it bad. Number six on your list. Number seven on your list.
Number seven on my list is number five in a franchise, Pirates of the Caribbean Part 5, Dead Men Tell No Tales, in which Johnny Depp just tells the audience, I'm sick and tired of playing Jack Sparrow, and you should be sick and tired of watching me play Jack Sparrow.
Okay, number eight on my list is Going in Style, a remake of a wonderful little movie from 1979. The original starred George Burns and Art Carney and Lee Strasberg as three retired old men living together who are bored with life, and so they decide to rob a bank. That movie is a classic. The remake has Michael Caine, Morgan Freeman, and Alan Arkin, three of our best veteran actors. But it's the opposite of a classic. It's formulaic, it's predictable, it has a cop-out happy ending that is contrary to everything the original did right. Going in Style, instead of getting the bank getting ripped off, you get ripped off by spending time watching this movie.
You know what's one of the great comedies of all time is Midnight Run.
Oh, yeah.
You know what's one of the worst movies of this year?
Midnight Run.
No.
Oh.
I like that now. The Hitman's Bodyguard, which is trying to do a Midnight Run-ish kind of movie.
Yeah.
Where Ryan Reynolds has to escort Sam Jackson to court so he can testify against Gary Oldman.
Yep.
This is just a horrific film.
Except
not
for Salma
funny.
Hayek.
Salma Hayek has two scenes, and she's very funny in those scenes, but she cannot prevent this movie from being on my worst of
That's list. Your number nine for this year?
Yes.
My number nine is another Richard Gere movie. Two on the worst of list for Richard Gere. It's called Norman. Now, when you think of Richard Gere, don't you think of a character who's a classy, good-looking Gentile?
Mm-hmm.
In this one, he plays a schlubby Jew in his 60s.
Well, okay. It's too bad they couldn't find an actor who could have fit that, you know, I mean... We don't have any older Jewish actors, I guess, so they have the kid.
Not only that, the director, Joseph Seder, uses a score that makes it sound like it was lifted from Curb Your Enthusiasm. So that made me think, is this a satire? Is it a straight-on drama? You know, I give Richard Gere credit for doing smaller movies. I hope that's not all he can get, because he's a pretty good actor when he puts his mind to it. He should never have put his mind to this. Norman. Ugh, terrible. All right, you're number 10.
A Dog's Purpose.
I even forgot that this came out.
It was this year. It had Dennis Quaid, and it had Josh Gad, who, of course, is Olaf, the snowman in Frozen, voicing this dog who is reincarnated about every 10 minutes in this movie. Why, you ask? Because he is killed horribly. They shoot the dog. They drown the dog. This is every 10 minutes a puppy dies. The audience cries and says, oh, I can't believe it. Yes, because they're killing puppies in front of you. And everybody's like, what a great emotional movie. No. They're just killing puppies.
Oh, you know what? I would love to have been in the pitch meeting for this. I would have laughed just like I laughed when you were describing it right here. And I would have absolutely not greenlit that movie.
Every 10 minutes, Josh Gad's like, oh, I guess I'm back. Now I'm a police dog. Wonder what's going to happen to me. Bang, bang, bang. I hated this movie.
Number 10 on my list is The Florida Project, which is actually in the top 10 movies for a lot of other critics.
It is. It absolutely is.
This movie is set in a motel in Orlando. It is full of lower class people trying to scrape by day to day without much money. And there's nothing wrong with that. I give them props when they try to reach down and better their lives. But it's summertime when this movie takes place, and the kids aren't in school, and they make their own fun and their own trouble. And remember last year when Moonlight won the Oscar, people were talking about how it was so nice for it to show us a portion of humanity whose stories rarely get told on screen. That's true. But the main characters in The Florida Project are so unlikable that I left the theater with a very bad taste in my mouth. I think it would be hell to live in that motel with some of these kids and their mothers. There were other people in that motel who probably had really intriguing stories. I wish I could have heard any of those instead of spending time with these kids and adults. A waste of my time and yours. So there are our top 10 lists for the worst movies of 2017. 1 week from today, we'll go the opposite and tell you our view of the best movies of the year. Here on the Showbiz Show, I'm Paul Harris. That's Max Foisy. This is the Big 550 KTRS.